Everybody loves a good heist story, especially a successful one. Chuck in corrupt politicians, corporate gangsters, and billionaire warlords, and you've got yourself a winning formula. Set your story in the 17th century, make your protagonist a handsome, mutinous pirate on the run, and you're looking at a surefire Hollywood blockbuster. Except that in this case, there isn't one. Henry Avery pulled off the heist of the century when in 1694 he seized his ship in a mutiny, sailed halfway around the globe, and bailed up a treasure fleet owned by the mighty Mughal Emperor of India, Aurangzeb. The result was not only the richest treasure haul in history, but an abject humiliation for the Sultan and a collapse of the tenuous trade agreement with the fledgling East India Company that almost triggered a war. The scandal provoked the first ever global manhunt, with the absconding captain evading all attempts at capture, vanishing into thin air, and being one of the few significant pirates in history to ever get away with it. His exploits turned him into an English folk hero, with ballads, books, and even theatre immortalising and mythologising his deeds. Avery's short but audacious career served as an inspiration to dozens of more well-known and notorious pirates that were to prowl the oceans over the following century. And yet, though his story supplied the archetype of the swashbuckling and evasive hero to dozens of films, his name has today been largely forgotten, despite the fact that the resultant political and economic shockwaves of his robbery would eventually topple empires and go on to change the course of history. If you're just a little bit curious about how one man, with a little luck and lots of ingenuity, could create such pandemonium, then join us, me hearties, as we dive into the life and times of legendary pirate Captain Henry Avery.
Heroes and Legends documentary channel. Not just the who, what, and the where, but also the why.
Our story begins in the late 1650s. Despite the end of the bloody 30 Years' War in Europe that ended in 1648 with the Treaty of Westphalia, Spain and France, though both Catholic, had been on opposite sides of the conflict and still had quite a score to settle. But it was becoming clear that both sides had exhausted their reserves and had fought themselves to a complete standstill. England, under the brutal rule of Oliver Cromwell and his murderous regime, had crushed all resistance and were mopping up whatever Catholics there were left alive in Ireland. In one of history's more curious arrangements, the Commonwealth of England, now allied to Catholic France, had sent Protestant troops across to help wrest Dunkirk from the Spanish, only to keep it for themselves as a prize, while the Spanish in turn gave sanctuary to the exiled English monarch Charles II, who had, till then, been living the high life in Paris under the protection of his French relatives. Try to get your head around that. But when Cromwell died in 1658, ineptitude and anarchy began to set in, and a military coup pushed for the dissolution of Parliament and for fresh elections, which, fortunately, resulted in a much more tolerant and stable working government in London. You don't see that very often. Anyway, this state of affairs ushered in the possibility of a restoration of Charles II to the throne, as well as peace with Spain. But ongoing mercantile competition, and eventually war with the Dutch, took a significant toll on both the army and the navy. It was into this precarious political and military environment that our protagonist was born, around 1659. Now, it has to be said that there are conflicting accounts regarding not only his birth, but even his name, though most historians agree that Henry was most likely born in Newton Ferrers, Devon, a region in the south of England, which, along with Cornwall, are famous for its maritime heritage, as well as the accent we all recognise as being typical of pirate speak. You know, shiver me timbers, thar she blows. Walk the plank, ye scurvy dog.
Mutiny, aye.
And so on. His parents were John and Anne Avery, and parish records suggest he was born on August 20, 1659. The surname is common enough in the region, though it was often spelled with several variations. Because later testimonies and his only signed letter were spelled beginning with an E, we'll stick with this usage from now on. The circus of competing alliances, as well as labour shortages arising from bubonic plague epidemics, caused a drain on manpower, as well as widespread displacement and homelessness all throughout the British Isles. Parliament increasingly made use of vagrancy laws to round up the homeless by roving press gangs, drafting them into the Navy, though it should be said that this practice mostly targeted sailors in seaside towns. But if you just happened to be accosted by a press gang, they gave you a choice: volunteer and be given a 2-month wage bonus, as well as indemnity from private debts less than £20, or alternatively, be taken by force, which would result in months of squalor, disease, and frequently death by confinement while you awaited assignment to a ship. Not a hard choice for most blokes down on their luck, or too drunk to escape. When Charles II was installed on the throne, he encouraged English expansion into North America, from Hudson Bay in Canada to the Carolinas in the south, and his ongoing conflict with the Dutch necessitated access to ever more funds that were becoming harder to obtain from a tight-fisted parliament. His marriage to Catherine of Braganza cemented an alliance to Portugal and brought him a number of colonial possessions by way of her dowry, notably Tangier on the Moroccan coast, a number of trade concessions in the East Indies and Brazil, access to Portuguese slave markets throughout West Africa, and notably for the purposes of our story, the Seven Islands of Bombay in India. And this is where we now turn our attention. It wasn't just Europe that was going through a tumultuous period of upheaval. Over on the other side of the globe, descendant of mighty Turco-Mongolian warlord Tamerlane, the Mughal Emperor Aurangzeb was making Oliver Cromwell look like a complete amateur by seizing the throne from his father Shah Jahan, executing all his brothers, and mobilizing to expand the Muslim Empire to what would be its greatest ever extent on the subcontinent. His father, Shah Jahan, was one of several consecutive tolerant Muslim rulers who had a pluralistic and pragmatic approach to ruling the vast multi-ethnic and multi-religious empire. Laws were enacted enshrining the protection of minorities, relaxing economic and bureaucratic discrimination against non-Muslims, and equalizing the tax code for all citizens. He is most well known in the West, though, for building the beautifully iconic Taj Mahal, the picture postcard mausoleum of his beloved wife in Agra near Delhi. When he suddenly took ill, his eldest son had been named his successor, but that's not how things were done in India. You see, there was no law of primogeniture, such as in Europe, and it was considered normal custom for sons to overthrow their aging fathers and then fight it out with their brothers for ultimate supremacy. Winner take all. Losers bite the dust. So when the old man's prostate got the better of him, his four sons scrambled to assemble armies, and soon it was on for young and old. Aurangzeb, the third of these four sons, was not only a talented commander in the field, but also a charismatic and shrewd player behind the scenes. At the age of just 15, he single-handedly took on a war elephant who had gone berserk in the Royal Parade Ground, earning him some serious cred for his bravery. He also held numerous governorships throughout his father's empire, pacifying rebellions and improving agricultural output, and was now being seen by courtiers as a serious contender for the throne. As the brothers now scrambled to gather supporters, Aurangzeb soon emerged as the key player, and within just 12 months, he had bribed and beheaded his way to the throne. Unlike his predecessors, Aurangzeb was an old-school, hard-line Sunni Muslim and rampaged his way across India in a campaign of Islamization not seen for over a century. He reaffirmed Sharia law, reintroduced the jizya, or infidel tax, applied to all non-Muslim subjects that his father had previously abolished. And he frequently toppled schools and temples of Hindus all across the empire, in an iconoclasmic campaign not seen since the days of Mahmud of Ghazni, an Afghan warlord who also, shall we say, discomfited a lot of Hindus with the edge of the sword. The result was a tyrannical, authoritarian regime with a centralized power structure and enormous tax revenue. Estimates suggest that the Indian economy under his reign was the single largest in the entire world, supplanting even the Qing dynasty of China and contributing 25% of the entire global GDP, an income at least 10 times that of France, making Aurangzeb the single richest man in the world at the time by far. As both Charles II in England and Aurangzeb in India ascended their thrones almost at the same time, the contrast could not be more stark. England had almost been broken economically by decades of domestic as well as continental warfare. Its population had been ravaged by both plundering armies and the Black Plague, and Charles was navigating the dangerous waters of religious schism, playing the nice guy and generally subject to the tight control of his parliament, who viewed him with unending suspicion. His mostly ineffective rule was characterized by schmoozing the ladies.
It's good to be the king.
Rather than leading his nation. But Charles' desperate lack of cash motivated an interest in both science and commerce, his sponsoring the formation of the Royal Society and looking outward to take advantage of opportunities in the new world. While Aurangzeb, comfortable, turned his entire focus on the Indian subcontinent. Looking at the two rulers and the state of their nations at the time, nobody could have dreamt that within just 100 years, England would become a global superpower and Mughal India would be reduced to a humiliating shadow of its mighty past. Scholars generally agree that this was largely due to India's policy of isolationism, which, though advanced in many ways, saw it gradually fall behind by failing to adopt innovations from abroad. A situation that would eventually be a critical factor following the daring heist of a complete nobody by the name of Henry Every. But we're getting just a little ahead of ourselves. While Aurangzeb was busy clamping down on his empire with an iron fist, Europeans had long been busy ingratiating themselves with any ruler that would grant them trade privileges, or demanding them under threat of cannon fire. The Portuguese, having long established their presence in the Indian Ocean since Vasco da Gama's, how shall we say, ungentlemanly exploits in Calicut in 1498, had secured themselves a number of trading bases along the Indian coast and beyond, from whence they returned with spices and textiles that made them wealthy beyond anything seen in Europe. You see, despite their enormous wealth and military power, India was never really a powerful maritime nation, their Hindu religion forbidding the sailing over deep waters. This religious taboo, known as Kala Pani, insisted that crossing the seas to other lands caused not only a corruption of the spirit, but also of social value that would require years of penitent fasting and ritual purification to reverse. Consequently, and with a few exceptions in their projection of power to Southeast Asia, they never developed much of a blue water navy, or for that matter, even a merchant fleet, which the Arabs and Chinese quickly capitalized on by establishing their own maritime trading empires that dominated the region. By now, the Mughal Empire, though Muslim, was so focused on internal conquest that it never really redressed this deficiency, though they did later develop a significant presence of their own, operated largely by African immigrants, who provided both mercantile and pilgrim services to the Red Sea. But even with the increased naval activity under Islamic rule, their naval power was inadequate to police the widespread piracy that plagued the Indian Ocean, and to repel this new threat of European businessmen who continually pressed their demands for a treaty. The English, seeing the ease with which the Portuguese were cashing in on Oriental trade, were most irritated at being left out of the action and were itching to get in on it themselves. Most people have heard of Francis Drake and Sir Walter Raleigh. To the English, they are swashbuckling hero adventurers who gave the Spanish what for, exciting the popular imagination by sailing deep into enemy territory and back out again, punching far above their weight and coming home with vast riches. But to the Spanish, they were little more than state-sanctioned pirates, attacking fellow Christian vessels and plundering entire towns on behalf of their rapacious queen, which, to be fair, is pretty much accurate. You see, ever since the Pope had formalized possession of the New World between the Spanish and the Portuguese, granting them exclusive ownership not only of the Americas but also the Far East, other European players, notably the English and the French, took a dim view, ignoring the papal decree altogether and scrambling to get a foothold for themselves, at least in North America. Their monarchs would grant charters to aspiring adventurers to explore, claim, and establish settlements, as well as to plunder Spanish shipping, but there was often very little material support to assist them. Consequently, they were forced to raise capital through recruiting investors, often by the formation of joint venture companies, and issuing shares of the profit when an expedition concluded in what modern brokers would call terminable stock. The Crown would license a company to act on its behalf, and in return would receive a substantial share of the spoils, profit, typically at 50%. Drake, whose voyage was the first English and second overall to successfully circumnavigate the globe in 1580, returned to London with trade goods that netted his investors a profit margin of over 4,600%. How's that for a return? Unsurprisingly, Queen Elizabeth knighted him, and this lowly commoner was now given his own coat of arms with the motto, Sic Parvis Magna, from small things, greatness. Imagine being an impoverished young peasant boy, sitting, shoeless, scruffy, and hungry, on the pier of any seaside town in England and looking outwards toward the open sea. How many do you think might have fantasized about sailing the seven seas, going on adventures and becoming rich and powerful? As the motto says, from humble beginnings to greatness. At a time of great social stratification, poverty and repression, who wouldn't be inspired by the possibilities, even today? Sir Walter Raleigh, on the other hand, wasn't so lucky. Let me explain. Unlike Drake, Raleigh was born into the landed gentry, which gave him plenty of opportunities to serve the crown by participating in military campaigns in Ireland and France, earning himself honours and the attention of the royal court. Handsome and charismatic, the Queen took a liking to him and granted him a charter to establish colonies in the Americas, which would serve both to profit England and act as bases against the Spanish. So far, so good. From there, he would go on to chase fantasies of El Dorado, serve in Parliament, and even end up in jail, more than once. But when he plundered a Spanish town, against orders, during a truce, he not only lost his son, who was killed during the battle, but soon after he lost his own head when the Spanish demanded justice. Sir Walter Raleigh was an example of a privateer who let freedom get to his head, but his many heroic exploits endeared him to the common folk, who viewed his execution as unjust, and they lionized him for decades. Incidentally, he was also an accomplished poet, and a number of historians have suggested that he and others were the secret authors of a number of works attributed to William Shakespeare. With the figure we refer to as the Bard from Stratford-upon-Avon merely being a frontman for a secret scriptorium. See my documentary on Shakespeare, the genius we never knew, for a fascinating look at this mysterious individual. Anyway, it was clear that forming joint venture companies was a great way of raising the cash needed to pursue both the Crown's political as well as economic goals. The Italians were masters of it, and their bankers in London gave the English an excellent schooling. By 1600, Queen Elizabeth I sanctioned the formation of one such corporation, the Governor and Company of Merchants of London trading into the East Indies, which history would eventually come to know as the East India Company. Elizabeth granted them a charter for 15 years, with a monopoly on all trade west of the Straits of Magellan and east of the Cape of Good Hope. Any English vessel or entity that was caught trading in that zone was deemed to be trading illegally and would have their ships, goods, and property seized and appropriated by the company, which would, of course, hand over 50% of the profits to the Crown. Within a decade, ships of the East India Company were marauding the Indian Ocean and now plundering Portuguese ships and settlements as far away as China, in cahoots with the Dutch, who had also formed a company, but whose structure was much more recognisable to us today, being that of a joint stock company, in which designated stocks could be purchased by any individual in the open market, and in which shareholders had perpetual ownership in the company, rather than just the temporary, expedition-based, terminable stock of the English variety. One of the benefits of this kind of company structure is that it spread the risk widely across hundreds of small shareholders and also allowed for a more continuous cash flow buffer that defrayed operating costs and reinvested a portion of its profits into the growing of the business. It also had the interesting side effect of creating a completely new phenomenon, the stock exchange, where people could buy and sell their shares publicly as incoming news fluctuated the price up or down, depending on events. Investors could now make money not just through dividends, but also in trading the shares themselves. For the time being, the English were content to keep their stocks and profits jealously secure among rich private investors. But over time, they too opened up the company to public trading, though its board of directors was notorious for what we call insider trading. That is to say, timing their shareholder announcements such that they sold their own shares when profits and share prices were high, and then bought them up again, often anonymously, when announcements of loss or disaster caused a stampede to sell the now devalued stocks. As you might expect, directors frequently manipulated the market with fraudulent announcements to, shall we say, stimulate market conditions to suit themselves. Insider trading legislation was still a long way off, and company directors were, in the meantime, making a mozzer on the hapless suckers who bought high and, in desperation, sold low. And we think today's company directors are a bunch of sharks. Having made their presence felt on the world stage, the company now sent out a delegation to the ruling Mughal emperor, Aurangzeb's grandfather, Emperor Jahangir, in 1608, with an offer of friendship and trade between the two countries. However, before Captain Hawkins, the English representative, could reach him, Portuguese traders had raided his ship while it was moored in the harbour, plundered his goods and gifts for the emperor, and in cahoots with paid-off port authorities, had murdered a number of his crew and almost assassinated Hawkins himself. Somehow he managed to escape and eventually made it to the Sultan's court, in rags and fearing for his life, clutching the English king's offer of friendship, but unfortunately with little else to show for himself. The emperor, noted for his genial nature and becoming increasingly angered by Portuguese audacity, welcomed Hawkins and now declared him his royal ambassador, granting the English a privileged voice in court and eventually permission for them to establish a factory in the port city of Surat, which was, at the time, the largest trading port in India, servicing both the Arab and Far East markets. A factory, by the way, was the common term for a free trade zone, or trading post, which acted like a warehouse, a company base and customs point, where locals could trade with foreign merchants, and they in turn could store incoming and outgoing goods in transit. Hawkins' affable nature and fluency in the Turkish language endeared him to the Sultan, and he remained at court for over 3 years in a privileged position, with his personal journals offering us a rare and precious glimpse into the sheer opulence and unfathomable wealth of the Mughal Empire. Visit the Heroes and Legends documentary channel website for a link to some of these journals. One reason for the unusually friendly reception given to the English was that ever since Vasco da Gama's infamous first encounter, the Portuguese had been escalating raids on shipping lanes all throughout the Indian Ocean, plundering fat merchant vessels and disrupting not only its trade routes, but also pilgrim convoys on the way to Mecca. You recall that despite having massive land armies, Muslim ocean-going naval technology and gunnery by this time was beginning to lag behind that of the Europeans, who marauded the Indian Ocean, picking off treasure fleets, ransoming and often murdering entire shipfuls of pilgrims. There was little they could do but accede to Portuguese demands, with Aurangzeb's great-grandfather Akbar even being forced to pay the Portuguese money for permits and protection to sail on pilgrimage to Mecca. So the humiliation of previous emperors to both pay for transit permits in their own sphere of influence, as well as now to allow the Portuguese to have their own trade factories, was a sore point that the Mughals now hoped the English could help them redress. Given the English were, at the time, at war with the Portuguese, successive Mughal emperors took the view that my enemy's enemy is my friend. Hence, the East India Company's delegation was welcomed, incentivized, and their profits from trade soon began to eclipse that of the Portuguese. Jahangir's successor, Shah Jahan, you recall the one that built the Taj Mahal, similarly viewed the English as being preferable to the Portuguese, and granted them a number of further concessions to open factories in Madras and on the eastern coast. He later also extended the company's benefits by exempting it from customs duties, road tolls, and a number of other levies for goods coming into and out of their main trading hub at Surat. By 1647, the company had 23 factories throughout India and flooded the English market with silk, calico, and other textiles that were now all the rage in London. Despite insider trading, for the time being, the East India Company's fortunes were making everyone rich, as both share prices and dividends continued to rise, sometimes exponentially. By the 1650s, Portugal's holdings in the Far East were dwindling. Its painful forced union with Spain had made enemies of both the English and the Dutch, who gradually stripped away many of their colonial possessions. But with its new War of Independence from Spain, known to us as the Portuguese Restoration War, hostilities with the English and the Dutch now ended, such that the Netherlands, via their own East India Company, were by far and away the greatest beneficiaries of Portuguese domestic misfortune, with factories now extending all the way into the Pacific Spice Islands. The English now increasingly viewed their former allies, the Dutch, as the single greatest threat to their own business interests, and a number of Anglo-Dutch wars were the result. Too many for even one of my rabbit holes. Recall that in 1659, the Portuguese, now bosom buddies, handed over Bombay to the English as a marriage dowry, and Charles II soon leased out his new holdings in India to the company, who fortified it and made Bombay their new headquarters, because Surat was coming under increasingly frequent attacks by Marathan Hindu insurgents that proved to be a continuous thorn in Aurangzeb's side. This new Mughal emperor, Aurangzeb, was for the most part absorbed in suppressing rebellions and extending his own empire, and at first paid little attention to the mutual wrangling of Europeans on his periphery. As long as trade continued to profit his empire and pirate activity was minimal, he left them to their own devices. But as the company opened new trading posts along the Indian coast, its directors insisted that their firman, or sultan's charter, that exempted them from tax duties at Surat, actually extended to all their factories, particularly since the emperor seemed unable to permanently secure the safety of that port. Local governors, port authorities, and customs officials, long having established a symbiotic relationship with the company and keen on stimulating foreign investment, had a good thing going, and typically overlooked this wishful English interpretation of its trade charter. When Aurangzeb eventually re-established the jizya, or poll tax on infidels that I mentioned earlier, the company lobbied hard to insist they were exempt from these taxes too, since under Islamic law, such a tax was only to be levied on permanent citizens and not temporary residents or merchants. When the company tried to negotiate opening a factory in Bengal province in the east, its governor, more hard-line than most, not only denied the English the exemptions they were claiming, but also now applied the infidel levy on top. A flurry of furious correspondence ensued, ending unfavourably for the till now generously spoiled English. It may be that the empire increasingly saw the Portuguese as not only politically irrelevant, but militarily impotent, and with their new alliance to the English, the East India Company no longer served to counter Portuguese influence, and were now themselves dispensable as far as the Sultan was concerned. Aurangzeb needed all this extra cash to fight Hindu insurgents, so local businessmen were unable to negotiate a solution, with the company now upping the ante by taking matters into their own hands, blockading the recalcitrant governor's ports and raiding Mughal shipping to the Red Sea, just like the Portuguese had done a century before. It worked for them, so why not for us? While it's easy to take that kind of expediently simple explanation, and it may well be partially true, There was another, more serious reason why the company took such a drastic and extraordinarily foolhardy gamble for the mere sake of a couple of percent less profit. You see, there were some serious problems now facing the company board of directors back home in London. Charles II had died, and his brother James II had ascended the throne in 1685. He was an outright Catholic, with a personal popularity at rock bottom, so he needed all the friends he could get. The company, too, was now coming under increasing public scrutiny for their blatantly obvious insider trading, which prompted a number of parliamentarians to call for its charter to be dissolved, its monopoly to be broken, and Asian trade opened up to all competitors. As you can imagine, its share price fell through the floor, and the board of directors bribed politicians left, right, and centre to block dissolution bills being put before Parliament, with the King's Court doing what they could to keep their backers in business. The public eventually got wind of it, and the printing presses were running hot with articles denouncing the entire business. Desperation in the boardroom in London was now compounded by a loss of tax exemptions in India that threatened to eat into their bottom line. Subsequent parliamentary audits of the company's books revealed that there was a long line of outstretched palms that needed to be continually greased, from port authorities in India to politicians and even the royal family back home. At any moment, the gravy train could come to a grinding halt, and the directors, notably its CEO, Josiah Child, took extreme measures to prevent this from happening, even convincing the king to grant the company extraordinary powers to mint coins, raise troops, and even wage war, as well as negotiate treaties on the crown's behalf without any prior consultation. They even convinced King James to dispatch an armed fleet to serve their interests. So when the company began blockading Mughal ports and raiding local shipping lanes, things got hot very quickly in what we know today as the First Anglo-Mughal War, or more simply, Child's War. Despite ongoing negotiations with Aurangzeb's government, English raiding continued, blockading Red Sea pilgrim routes, which was something that really raised the ire of the emperor, who now paused his wars with the Hindu insurgents and directed his troops to seize and confiscate all company outposts and assets throughout the entire country. The massively outnumbered English were soon reduced to just their fortress on Bombay, which was now blockaded by a formidable new Mughal fleet assembled by their brilliant admiral, Sidi Yaqub Khan. The blockade lasted a year before the starving English surrendered in complete humiliation and begged the emperor not to expel them, promising instead to pay substantial compensation and consent to whatever penalties and taxation rates he demanded. It could have been the end of the English presence in India, there and then, and you have to wonder what the world would be like today had Aurangzeb banished them. But as it happened, he didn't, and having extracted a hefty fine and promises of better behaviour in the future, he not only returned their assets and outposts, but also, astonishingly, their previous trading privileges. Was he a sucker? Perhaps, but more likely, he was so engrossed in his domestic wars of conquest against the Hindu that he felt the English were barely a nuisance that could just as easily be crushed the next time they got cocky. The English, just like the Portuguese before them, also now promised to patrol the seas against pirates, and we know that this was a major consideration for the emperor too. By the way, this wasn't the last time the English would sit precariously on the edge of expulsion, but again, we're getting just a little ahead of ourselves. The ocean is a great leveller of men, where knowledge, bravery, and resilience are more important than skin colour or creed. During a time when more of the world was unknown than known, venturing out into the vast blue expanse was no joyride. A ship was vulnerable to everything from squalls and towering swells to rot and woodworm. It could be blown onto rocks and shattered to a million pieces, or spend weeks in a dead calm, where you could die of thirst or hunger while waiting endlessly for a favourable breeze. Death came in any number of ways, suddenly or gradually, frequently from trauma, but mostly through disease, whether it be a debilitating and painful nutritional deficiency, such as scurvy, or microbial, such as dysentery, sepsis, or fever, both outcomes often relating to inadequate and contaminated rations, which have been described in numerous accounts as disgusting beyond belief. On every metric, sailors had the odds stacked against them, with death an ever-present reality. And die they did by the thousands every year, and that's not even counting having your head blown off by a cannonball. There was plenty of that too, to be sure. Records indicate that mortality rates on long-haul voyages could be as high as 80% on average during the 1600s. The lucky ones only had to contend with malnutrition as well as chronic, pustulent venereal disease, which by some accounts was well over 25% of every crew, and which in the days before antibiotics was often fatal. Indeed, medical treatments were often more toxic than the diseases they purported to cure. But a ship was also a great place to do science, and doctors came up with any number of creative and bizarre therapies that takes a special kind of idiot to dream up. And speaking of doctors, many of them were little more than glorified butchers, if that. It says a lot when the ship's surgeon was typically just a trained-up barber. Stephen Johnson, in his excellent book, Enemy of All Mankind, describes a ship at sea during this time as literally a floating aquatic coffin, with living conditions and a mortality rate demonstrably worse than any other group you could possibly think of. So the burning question really is, why on earth would anyone be mad enough to voluntarily become a sailor? Well, part of the reason was the pay was often comparatively quite good. An experienced sailor could negotiate a wage equivalent to a skilled craftsman, without the additional expense of a workshop, raw materials or guild fees. And despite the lack of quality, food and booze were guaranteed for the entirety of the voyage, which was another significant expense avoided. But perhaps the largest lure was the prospect of sharing in the bounty of a bonus payout, should enemy ships be captured and plundered. Of course, when a prize was sold, dividends were first paid out to the crown and investors, but the officers and crew often received a share of the spoils too, sometimes in the order of 10 years' worth of pay. A lucrative temptation, particularly during times of war, when the crown would hire merchant ships as privateers, that is to say, state-sponsored pirates, to plunder enemy shipping and settlements. A ship's captain might be issued with a warrant or letter of marque that authorized them to act in most respects as a navy ship, though without the rigorous discipline and chain of command that naval officers were subject to. The benefit to the crown was that by issuing letters of marque, upfront military expenditure was minimal, both in wages and provisions, as well as in the construction of ships. Privateers were like Uber drivers with guns, who paid a percentage of their takings to the boss, but more or less did their own thing. However, sometimes they went rogue, or carried on raiding even after a peace deal was signed, just like what happened to Sir Walter Raleigh. The world was such a huge, poorly patrolled place, with so many areas to hide, that the temptation was often just too much to resist. And this is where privateers became a real headache. According to Johnson, the distinction between privateer and pirate was a deliberately blurry one. Now, given the gravity of such action, there arose a peculiar form of democracy aboard a privateer vessel. It was all well and good for a captain to give orders to attack enemy shipping. But violating neutrality, or even attacking allied ships, was a decision that would need the support of the crew. Contrary to popular belief, a privateer/pirate captain typically held meetings with all his officers and crew to discuss fresh or risky plans, and these were usually put to the vote. Neither charisma nor despotism was enough if the crew were starving or had sailed for months without scoring a prize. A captain was only as good as his last victory and could easily get booted if his men lost faith in him. Mutiny, of course, was always frowned upon and, in most circumstances, subject to the death penalty back home. But there were plenty of cases of privateer crews winning their court cases, where gross misconduct or incompetence of leadership had been found. But in the case of outright pirates, mutiny was just a fancy name for a snap election, or what we might call in politics, a leadership spill. News of Portuguese penetration beyond the Cape and subsequent conquests in the Orient were already common knowledge on the docks of Bristol, Portsmouth, and elsewhere in Britain. Indeed, there's plenty of evidence to suggest that fishermen all along the Atlantic seaboard were well aware even of North America long before Columbus' fateful voyage in 1492. See my video on the Codfish Heroes for a detailed account of many of these stories. Part of the reason news spread so rapidly within this community was that the crews of both merchant and sometimes naval vessels were regularly composed of sailors from ethnic backgrounds so diverse, it would surprise even the most progressive multicultural activist today. Merchant sailors were typically hired only for the term of a voyage and were free to seek new employment once it concluded. If conditions were poor or the omens bad, many deserted well before then during resupply stops, only to join other ships passing by, never to be seen again. Captains were always desperate to fill vacancies brought on by the attrition of death or desertion, so they typically asked few questions and rewarded any fresh intelligence that could net them extra profits. With Charles II's restoration to the throne in 1660, England and Spain normalised their diplomatic relations, with trade and shipping passing through each other's ports freely. Its on-again, off-again sparring with the Dutch was also currently on pause, so they quickly capitalised on the lull by engaging in widespread trade throughout the South Atlantic, importing goods from Spain and her colonies and trading supplies of their own, from the Caribbean all the way to Africa. Strapped for cash, Charles commissioned the formation of the Royal African Company, which was initially tasked with procuring gold from the Gambia River Basin and given a complete monopoly on African trade, much as the East India Company had in the Orient. But company directors soon concluded that the slave trade was a much more lucrative endeavour and quickly joined the Portuguese and Spanish in what was already a massive network of trafficking that was sending tens of thousands of helpless captives across to the New World. We don't know much about Henry Every's youth, but apocryphal accounts suggest that he was a sailor from a young age. One account has him aboard a Royal Navy vessel that bombarded Algiers in 1671, while another claims he was a buccaneer prowling the Caribbean. But the earliest concrete record we have comes from 1689, where, in his early 30s, he is reported to have been serving as a midshipman aboard the Royal Navy 64-gun third-rate ship of the line, the HMS Rupert. You recall that Spain and England were now chums, and nothing cements a friendship like ganging up on someone you both hate, in this case the French. You see, the 30 Years' War had exhausted everyone, but the French emerged from the conflict with a swag of new territories, greater control over its internal affairs, and a disconcerting amount of self-confidence. Louis XIV was massaging his cousin, James II, to Catholicise England, something that was really starting to irritate the English Parliament. James' daughter and heir to the throne, Mary, was married to Dutchman William of Orange, and when the French King Louis began eyeing off some of his fiefdoms, there was real concern that the husband of the future Queen of England might end up a French vassal. Such a scenario was completely unacceptable, so Parliament quickly cooked up a coup d'etat and removed James from the throne, replacing him with his daughter and Dutch son-in-law. Louis knew this was going to be a problem, and so declared war on both England and the Dutch Republic, but was too busy tussling for territory with the Germans to do much about it. In any case, he expected that James would pursue a lengthy and messy civil war to regain his throne, which would keep the English too busy to bother him on the continent. But James, having invaded Ireland, soon had his butt handed to him on a plate at the Battle of the Boyne, which allowed William to direct both Dutch and now English resources to the French theatre. To cut a long story short, the war ended more or less in a stalemate, with everyone out of cash and desperate to quit. But part of the outcome for England was that, with Dutch support, it beefed up its navy, which began to flex its muscles both at home and in North America. In 1689, Every, on board the Rupert, was involved in a naval battle off the coast of Brest, which captured a large French convoy and saw him promoted to the rank of master's mate. The next year he was serving on a new ship, the 90-gun second-rate ship of the line, HMS Albemarle, but interestingly he was recorded as being discharged from the Navy some months later. By 1691, he shows up in the record again as being in the Caribbean, working as a slave trader for the governor of Bermuda, a shady character cashing in on a shady side hustle. It seems he employed Every to sail up and down the coast of Guinea, rowing out to native settlements under false pretenses, and then capturing whoever came out to trade with them. Other captains, working for the Royal African Company, complained that this made it so much harder for them to do the same, and since they held the monopoly on abducting innocent civilians, they were most upset with him, angry even. Nevertheless, by 1693, he was back in Old Blighty and signed up for a venture organised by rich merchant and politician James Houblon. The Right Honourable MP had some tight connections over in Spain, and his wine import business was booming as a result. He wanted to capitalise further by establishing a small fleet of ships that would trade firearms and other goods to settlements throughout the West Indies, but which would also salvage the wreckage of sunken galleons, known to be treasure ships. Profits would be shared with the Spanish Crown, but such projects required a license, which his contacts soon obtained for him. Because salvage work would make them vulnerable to the attacks of local pirates, he commissioned the construction of the Charles II, a 40-gun frigate with a sleek new design that was faster than any comparable ship to date, and she was to be accompanied by another three somewhat less formidable merchantmen. The wealthy investors set about recruiting, promising a wage far in excess of standard naval pay, with 1 month's salary up front and regular pay delivered to the sailors' families throughout the voyage. They would also supply quality food and plenty of booze, an incentive almost as appealing as good pay. 200 men were recruited, including a complement of qualified officers experienced in sailing to the West Indies, with a couple even having salvage experience. Aboard the flagship, our protagonist, Henry Every, was hired as first mate, which suggests that he was well regarded as a seaman by officers in the know. Also aboard the Charles was enigmatic privateer-cum-scientist William Dampier, an extraordinary explorer and proto-naturalist who filled in plenty of blanks on what we now call Australia, and who was the first mariner to circumnavigate the world three times. Millennials will be grateful to know that he was the first European to describe the making of smashed avocado, no doubt on toasted sourdough, and to grace our dictionaries with the words chopsticks and barbecue. While his books, containing swashbuckling adventures and extensive descriptions of hitherto unknown flora and fauna, were a key inspiration for none other than Charles Darwin, who carried his book on board the Beagle over a century later. Dampier's is a fascinating and bizarre tale, well worthy of much more than just one of my little rabbit holes, and I'm sure we'll take a look at his story in a future video. But for now, the venture, to be known as the Spanish Expedition Shipping, made its way quietly down the Thames, oblivious to the fact that, within the next year, they would be involved in the heist of the century, almost trigger a war and spark the first global manhunt in history. The journey was to take them first to the Spanish port of A Coruña, where they would take on supplies, finalise paperwork, and then hitch a ride on the trade winds across to the West Indies. But for some unknown reason, the paperwork was slow in coming, and in the meantime, Spanish authorities confined the ships to an anchorage in the harbour and denied the crew permission to go ashore. A trip that was supposed to be a mere formality and last only 2 weeks now dragged on for 5 whole months. To make matters worse, the crew hadn't received their promised wages. The expedition leader, Admiral O'Byrne, understood the gravity of the situation and forwarded a petition by the crew back to London. But James Houblon, the CEO, responded by ordering the petitioners be thrown into the brig. Reports tell us that the sailors' wives back in London also confronted Houblon, who not only failed to reassure them, but dismissed them out of hand. Eventually, this would lead to a lawsuit, but given his political and judicial connections, you can imagine how that ended. This was the bloke who, with his brother, founded the Bank of England. Surprise, surprise. Anyway, the sailors, now cashless and frustrated, again pressed the Admiral, demanding their pay or threatening to go on strike. Unfortunately, O'Byrne's hands were also tied, and yet another petition on their behalf was again denied by London. The men were beginning to wonder what was to become of them. England and Spain had long been enemies, and few genuinely expected the present peace deal to last very long at all. Indeed, some were worried that there might already have been a collapse in diplomacy, and that they would all soon be rounded up and locked away forever, or worse, sold into slavery. Confrontation with the Admiral soon became heated, but it seems that O'Byrne was powerless to take the initiative and resolve the crisis. The result was a growing sense of dread among the crew, who now began plotting an alternative solution of their own to the impasse. And when the Admiral was slated for a function on shore, they finally acted. On the night of the 7th of May, 1694, plotters from the three lesser ships snuck aboard longboats and rowed out toward the Charles II. On board one of the other ships, an officer became suspicious and reported to his captain, who immediately recognized something was afoot, racing up on deck, only to see that their own longboat, full of men, was rowing out also towards the Charles. He gave an order to fire upon the rowboat, in order to alert the other ships. But by now, the Charles had already been secured, and the other rowboats had already pulled up alongside, their sailors also scrambling on board. First Mate Every, the ringleader, had spent the last few days visiting the other ships and secretly cajoling his crewmates to take control of their fate, assuring them that he knew a better way to secure their pay. The captain of the James now fired a salvo, instantly alerting not only the other vessels, but also the harbour night watch, who also raised an alarm. There was no time to lose. Every's conspirators quickly apprehended the other officers of the ship, bundling them away under arrest, while they unfurled sails, drew the anchor, and turned for the open seas. The hapless Captain Gibson, aboard the Charles, was delirious with fever in his cabin and completely oblivious to the unfolding drama, as the Charles slipped out of range of both English and Spanish guns without sustaining even a single casualty. Early next morning, Captain Gibson's fever finally abated enough for him to notice the ship rocking in the swell. Every paid him a visit and explained the situation. "Join us," he said, "and we will receive you, and if you turn sober and attend to business, perhaps in time I may make you up one of my lieutenants. If not, here's a boat, and you shall be set ashore." Captain Gibson roundly turned down the offer, as did 17 other officers and crew. True to his word, Every lowered a pinnace, even chucking in some supplies. They were now 10 miles out at sea, with the fortress already disappeared from the horizon, so he also threw them a bucket in case they began to take on water. As Captain Gibson looked around at his loyal companions, it was clear that there was still some room for others, and this detail would become an important factor in future court proceedings. But for the moment, Gibson's men got busy rowing. It was a long way back to shore, and the open ocean was no place for a vulnerable rowboat. Getting back alive was by no means guaranteed, but at least they had a chance. Other captains were often not so lucky during this period, and typically dispatched without a second thought. Now that they were safely away, one of the first orders of business was to confirm Every as captain and establish the ship's new bylaws, called the Articles of Agreement, in which the rights, obligations, and remuneration were formally decided upon. But first of all, Every decided to rechristen the ship with a new name, one that would encompass both their aspirations as well as define the vessel itself. Since her sleek, specially designed hull cut so efficiently and swiftly through the ocean swell, it was decided to name her the Fancy. She was as sexy as she was agile, while her elegant curves packed a deadly punch in the 40 guns she modestly kept tucked away from view. While we often view pirates as an unruly and volatile rabble, the truth is that, unlike most anywhere else in the world at the time, a pirate ship operated, in author Stephen Johnson's words, as a floating democracy, with each crew member having an equal vote in propositions and an astonishingly equal share in the profits of any venture. Very few documented articles or constitutions from the time survive, some being more complex than others, but generally speaking, there was a distinct separation of powers to ensure fairness and prevent abuse of position, a situation all too common on other sailing vessels. The captain was its CEO, elected to that position, but always subject to a no-confidence vote, when duly called on by a quorum of officers and crew. He held absolute authority during a battle and for setting the mission objectives, but the day-to-day running of the ship, wages, petty disputes, grievances, and even the setting of punishments was determined by the quartermaster, also elected by the crew, and who acted as their trustee. The quartermaster was first aboard any prize. He determined the division of spoils and supervised its fair distribution. As far as wages were concerned, the few surviving copies of pirate articles of agreement all begin not just by confirming the equal voting rights of each crew member, but also by establishing the division of profits. Some had one share for ordinary crew members, several for the captain, and one and one half or so for senior officers, and even a share or two set aside for maintenance of the ship, what we might today call operating expenses. We don't have a copy of Every's articles, but one thing we do know is that the dividends were to be distributed evenly, with each sailor receiving one share of the whole, and the captain two. Perhaps the most equitable division of wealth in the history of business. Find me a CEO or boss today whose wage is merely double that of the janitor. Anyway, pirate codes contained more than just a confirmation of voting rights and profit sharing, and you might be surprised to learn that literacy rates among pirates were substantially higher than the rest of the population, such that most men were perfectly capable of not only reading the content of their contract, but also signing their full name. It may be that long, uneventful days at sea gave them ample opportunities to learn how to read and write, particularly as they lived in close quarters with more educated officers who could teach them, unlike the strict segregation typical of the Royal Navy, or worse, town life back home, where the means were few. The articles also listed a man's responsibilities and the penalty for breaching them. For example, gambling for money was forbidden at all times aboard the vessel. Weapons were to be maintained, clean, and in good working order at all times. Lights out times and drinking locations were fixed for all crew members. Defrauding the ship's company for personal gain was punishable by having nose and ears cut off or by marooning. Smuggling women in disguise onto the ship was punishable by death. Desertion or abandoning one's post during battle was punishable by death. Brawling on board was forbidden. Personal disputes were to be settled on land by a duel, moderated by the quartermaster. First to draw blood was declared the winner. Shareholders were forbidden from retiring from the ship's company until they had accrued 1,000 shares of spoils in total. And perhaps most astonishingly of all, crew members were to pay a portion of their earnings into a mutual fund, from which crippled or injured sailors were paid compensation in proportion to the severity of their injuries while in the service of the ship. Such an egalitarian and democratic system, with checks and balances on the abuse of power, not to mention insurance schemes, was so far ahead of its time that it can be hard for us to comprehend today. But it highlights just how important notions of liberty were to pirate crews that they held such a constitution as a crucial guarantee to their way of life. Johnson suggests that it was this radical egalitarian and fraternal ethos that was at the heart of why their exploits were so popular among the poor and dispossessed back home. As they headed south along the Portuguese coast, it was clear that Every already had formulated a plan. You see, word had got out among the English tars, a slang word for sailors, that a certain Thomas Tew, who lived in the American colony of New York, had received a ship and letter of marque from the governor of Bermuda to gather a crew and sail for Africa, to destroy French factories and other assets along the Gambian coast. Tew had already been employed to molest French shipping in the Caribbean, and the English were now keen to strike at their gold markets in West Africa. But no sooner had they set sail than Tew proposed an alternative venture to his crew. the French factories were well defended and likely to inflict significant casualties with their shore batteries. He instead suggested they scrap that plan and instead go round the Cape and head for the Mandab Strait, a bottleneck at the opening of the Red Sea, where they could prey upon juicy Indian merchantmen, just like the Portuguese had been doing for decades. So, in late 1693, they found themselves in position and pounced on a fat and sluggish Indian Ganga dhow that surrendered without a fight and which was laden with gold, silver, spices, silks, ivory and gemstones worth well over £100,000, about £15 million in today's currency. When the spoils were divided, each crew member received at least £1,500 each, enough to set them up in luxury for the rest of their lives. They had not incurred even one casualty and barely fired a shot before making their way back south to Madagascar to party at one of the several fledgling pirate towns that sprang up on the coast. He eventually made his way back to New York, and with his own share of the loot, Tew became the toast of the town, quite the dandy, and soon best buddies with the governor, Benjamin Fletcher, who was himself something of a sponsor and supporter of local pirates, no doubt benefiting with plenty of backsheesh for turning a blind eye. Manus ab manum, as the Romans used to say. Anyway, Tew's exploits showed just how easy it could be for a well-prepared and disciplined team to strike it rich, making a lifetime's income in one hit, and all without engaging another Christian nation, which would avoid the complicated problems inherent in European politics. Tew's adventure around the Cape and into the juicy Indian Ocean hunting grounds would come to be known as the Pirate Rounds, and inspire generations of European pirates to imitate his example. And now, less than a year after his daring raid, Every was himself planning to be the next Englishman to pull off the big one. The Bermuda governor who gave Captain Tew his letter of marque, only to be double-crossed, was the very same governor who hired Every to engage in slave plundering just a couple of years ago. And it may be that Every and Tew actually knew each other, which would have carried some weight in his proposal to the crew of the Fancy to replicate his raid. While they had plenty of supplies, there was just one problem facing Every and his band of merry men. They had 46 guns and plenty of ammo, that is to say powder, shot and ball, but barely 80 men in total. It takes at least 6 men to man a cannon properly, so they would need at least triple that number of crew in order to maximize their firepower. They now made their way to the Cape Verde Islands, a Portuguese colony, where they split up and boarded 3 English trade ships in the harbour, detained their captains at gunpoint and plundered their supplies, recruiting 9 of their own crew to join them. But peculiarly, Every now wrote out IOUs for the forced requisition, promising to repay the owners for their loss, and handed it over to the bewildered and traumatized captains. The Fancy then continued south, along the African coast and into the Gulf of Guinea, where they anchored offshore of a native village, pretending to be traders, and engaged in the age-old tactic of luring locals on board, seize and lock them up, presumably to be used as labour and then traded as slaves further along the journey. It was now time to prepare the ship for the task at hand. The Fancy was already a sleek and agile warship, but Every first had her careened on the small Portuguese slave market island of Fernando Po to scrub and maintain her hull, to remove barnacles and other accumulated ocean detritus that would increase drag. Without the benefit of dry dock, this was a necessary task on all sea-going vessels and had to be done regularly, or it would seriously hamper their manoeuvrability. It was also an opportunity to inspect the timbers situated below the waterline, which were always subject to rot and burrowing caused by shipworms, the silent scourge of any sea captain. Even the densest of hardwood hulls needed to be careened on a beach at least every 2 years, otherwise a ship was at risk of catastrophic breakup, even in moderate swells. With the adoption of expensive copper sheeting by the Royal Navy in the 1760s, these risks were mitigated to some degree, but for the time being, ships used a combination of sulphur and tar pitch pastes covered with replaceable wood sheeting that acted to prevent fouling and rot, but the hull would nevertheless still need to be inspected at regular intervals. Having refloated her, the captain now made a further decision to completely remodel the top deck, removing the sterncastle and even the captain's quarters, leaving the deck flat and aerodynamic, something that he knew would increase her speed even more, as well as lower her profile and exposure to gunfire. No sooner had they got underway than they ran into a pair of Danish privateers, engaging them in a brief firefight near the islands of Principe. The Fancy's guns, undermanned as they were, nevertheless still proved overwhelming, and the Danes quickly surrendered, offering up a barrel of gold, ivory, fabrics, firearms, and even 50 large casks of brandy. Yo-ho-ho! The score was made all the better when 17 Danish crew members requested to join them, and so the Fancy's own crew now numbered about 100 men in total. Out into the open Atlantic again they sailed, away from the African coast and southward, till they caught the west wind drift, known to us today as the Antarctic Circumpolar Current, a massive ocean current flowing clockwise around Antarctica. The westerly winds that are associated with it make it the most efficient means of sailing from west to east, avoiding the treacherous seas and rocks of the Cape, though the risk of icebergs at that southerly latitude means that summertime is the only safe time to traverse it. By early 1695, they sighted the Madagascar coast, a well-known pirate haven, where they rested, stocked up on provisions, and formulated their further plans, while again careening the ship for another scrub and maintenance job. They spent some months here, which suggests that Every was aware that there was an ideal time to conduct his raid. The monsoon winds of the northern summer months in July and August made sailing easier and brought increased seagoing traffic from Asia to Arabia. The fact that he had never been here himself suggests he may well have met and even plotted with Thomas Tew, who, if you recall, had pulled off his own audacious heist just the year before. Or perhaps he had access to Portuguese and Spanish intelligence from some of his own crew members about Indian Ocean weather patterns. In any case, by early spring they were off again, headed for one of the Comoro Islands, engaging and capturing a French privateer that was itself hunting for English merchant ships. Pilfering its supplies, they scuttled it in the harbour, which had the benign effect of encouraging 40 of its crew to lobby Every to sign up with him. I suppose we could say that their own articles became null and void in the event of capture. At the local town of Johanna, Every took the extraordinary step of writing a letter to be given to any passing English ship, in which he asserted that he had no issue with his own countrymen and that if they wanted to communicate, to use a secret signal which he indicated in the letter. Should the Fancy come across an English ship at sea that did not use that signal, he could not guarantee that his crew would not board and plunder them. Either way, no hard feelings. No sooner had he come back on board than three East India Company ships appeared out of nowhere and began closing in on their position. The order was quickly given to weigh anchor, and as she let fly, it quickly became clear that the Indiamen were being left for dead in her wake. The astonished pursuers broke off the chase and returned to the harbour, picking up Every's letter and later reporting to their supervisors when they reached Bombay that she was too nimble for them by much, having taken down a great deal of her upper works and made her exceedingly snug, which causes her to sail so hard now that she fears not who follows her. Every's conciliatory gesture was dismissed out of hand, and the three company captains correctly surmised that she was now on her way to the Red Sea, correctly predicting that their predations would cause much havoc to the company's operations in India. Every's crew was now 150 men strong, good, though still not at optimal capacity, but they nevertheless made their way north, rounding the Somalian coast into the Gulf of Aden, which even today is a lawless nest of piracy. Recent events off the Yemeni coast indicate just how vulnerable shipping is and always has been. They anchored near the town of Maid and set ashore to procure supplies, but when the town leadership rebuffed them, it was clear that Every's men were not about to take no for an answer. In a region famous for sheltering pirates, it seems a rather naively undiplomatic move to refuse hospitality to armed marauders, and the consequences for the town were that it got plundered instead, the furious crew even blowing up the local mosque with gunpowder. Having made their point, the Fancy moved deeper into the Gulf, toward the bottleneck at Bab al-Mandeb, but now ran into two more ships, this time Americans, the Dolphin and the Portsmouth Adventure. But this run-in was far from hostile, and together they dropped anchor off the small volcanic island of Perim, smack bang in the middle of the channel, just waiting for a fat, juicy merchant ship to come floating by. Instead, the next day, another three American pirate ships showed up, including the brig Amity, commanded by none other than Thomas Tew, who it seems was back to have a second crack at the treasure fleet. And it turns out that this summer, the monsoon sailing season teamed up precisely with the pilgrimage season, which meant that the targets would be even fatter and richer than usual. It was clear that, if they worked together, the pirates could hit some big targets and really clean up, so they spent all night parleying and planning. Now, you'd think, if they could even cooperate at all, that Thomas Tew, given his previous experience and knowledge of the area, would be the natural choice of leader of any joint mission. But in this case, it seems that there was some honour among thieves, because given the Fancy's immensely superior firepower, as well as agile manoeuvrability, Every was given overall command of the deadly flotilla, which now had a crew of almost 450 men in total, a significant force for the time. The trap was now set, but as the weeks went by, there was little traffic of note coming down the passage, and the men, sweltering in the summer heat, became increasingly restless. Every sent a pinnace with a few men northwards to scout for signs of a treasure fleet, and soon enough, they returned with news of a 25-ship pilgrim convoy making its way south from Mecca. This convoy consisted of the Fateh Muhammad, a 3,200-ton Mughal man-o-war, perhaps the largest ship in the Indian Ocean, bristling with 94 guns and 800 crew armed with muskets. It was owned by Indian businessman Abdul Ghaffar, reputedly the richest merchant in Surat, and whose merchant fleet alone did more business than the entire East India Company combined. On this journey, it acted as an escort to the Gunj-e-Sawai, another massive Gunjar Dhow, of 1,600 tons, with 80 guns and owned by the Mughal Emperor Aurangzeb himself. Reports tell us that the Ganj-e-Sawai, which the English sailors anglicised as Gunsway, was returning from a pilgrimage trip to Mecca with over 1,000 passengers aboard, including a female relative of the emperor, thought by some to be his granddaughter or niece. Together, these two ships alone easily outgunned and outmanned the pirate flotilla, dwarfing the Fancy, whose exposed top deck would have made for easy pickings by Indian snipers firing from way above them. Nevertheless, the pirate flotilla got busy making final arrangements, hoping to spring a trap as their victims sailed by. But as the next couple of days came and went, there was still no sight of the target, and it became increasingly clear that they must have slipped by in the dead of night, right under their nose. So the pirates scrambled to give chase. One of the ships was taking on water, so they scuttled it, with the crew coming on board with Every. Another ship was way too slow, so the Fancy attached a tow line and dragged it along, and even with this extra drag was still faster than any of the others. Thomas Tew's Amity gradually began to fall behind and disappeared over the horizon. Frantically, the pirates scanned the ocean for their prey, heading northeast along the Arabian coast. But after 10 days, there was still no sight of them. They were beginning to despair that their quarry had got away. All this planning, a year in the making, and time was now slipping through their fingers. The captain now had no choice but to set course for Surat, hoping they might at least catch a straggler, and sure enough, just in sight of the Indian coast, on the 7th of September, they spotted the Fateh Muhammad, its sheer bulk causing it to lag behind the others. Every now gave orders to swing wide, overtake it and hit it from the front the next day. As dawn broke, sure enough, with the pirates laying in wait, she emerged from the morning fog, and the Fancy positioned herself for a broadside, strafing the Mughal warship with everything she had. The Behemoth replied with several cannons it had on its prow, missing its agile target, and, to Every's astonishment, the ship now struck its colours before the Fancy had even come about for a second volley. The largest ship in the Indian Ocean had just surrendered to a pipsqueak without so much as giving a reply. Now, there's been quite some conjecture as to why, and details are a bit sketchy, but it seems that while the Fancy and her small entourage had been scouring the northeast sector, the Amity, under Captain Tew, continued on its original trajectory, and despite its own modest speed, nevertheless caught up with the Mughal warship ahead of everyone else, and engaged it all alone a couple of days before. Apparently, it had been completely obliterated by the Mughal defences, and poor old Captain Tew had his guts blown out by a cannonball, but not before inflicting some serious damage of their own. Apparently, the good ship Amity and her commander were now on their way to Davy Jones' locker, while the Fateh Muhammad limped on home. It seems that whatever damage was sustained by the Mughal warship was enough to warrant its surrender, and so now, minus Captain Tew, the remaining pirate crews boarded the vessel and raided its hold, netting a hoard of gold and silver that, when divided, amounted to over 5 years' standard pay for each sailor. Fantastic, but not quite enough to satisfy Every. So they took control of the ship and anchored off the coast, hoping for yet more stragglers. Sure enough, 2 days later, another huge vessel came into view. It was the Gunsway herself, its huge hulk gently ploughing through the water, straight at them. Captain Every knew better than to expect the Emperor's own flagship to go down without a fight, and so he ordered all the crew to battle stations and readied for a David and Goliath showdown that would end in either glory or death. Captain Tew could have lived out his life in New York, in comfort and luxury, but chose to go down fighting. To anyone assessing the odds, it seemed that Captain Every had the same kind of death wish. So the Fancy rapidly closed in on her quarry, trailed like a shark by her slower companions. When they came into range, she swung about and raked the Mughal warship with everything she had. Maneuvering to come about and blast her with the other broadside, almost at point-blank range, the Mughal mainmast came crashing down. It had taken a direct hit from a cannonball, causing chaos on deck and seriously disabling her ability to maneuver. The gunsway was now a sitting duck. A very big one, mind you, but sitting nevertheless. The two ships were so close now that the Mughal Marines opened up with musket fire, picking off the pirates on deck like fish in a barrel. But as their gunners readied to blast the Fancy clean out of the water, one of their own cannons exploded, raining fire and shrapnel across the gunsway's decks, killing dozens and maiming dozens more. Fire broke out, incinerating its remaining sails and suffocating the soldiers with acrid smoke. Such pandemonium broke out that they didn't even get off a salvo before Every's pirates clambered aboard, soon joined by those of their fellow ships coming alongside to reinforce them. A ferocious and desperate hand-to-hand battle ensued and carried on for almost 3 hours, with the pirates, though outnumbered at least 3-1, gradually gaining the upper hand, as smoke billowed and flames raged on around them. The gunsway's captain, apparently known to be a lecherous aristocrat, soon lost his nerve and ran below deck, leaving his leaderless men to carry on fighting. Contemporary Mughal sources tell us that the captain had recently purchased a dozen Turkish slave girls in the markets of Arabia and was taking them home to Surat, but that he now burst into their quarters, armed them with swords, and sent them out to fight, while he tried to disguise himself and hide in the rabbit warren of cabins in which there were over 1,000 passengers, many of them pilgrims. Suffice it to say, the slave girl's kung fu was not strong, and eventually the defenders lost heart and surrendered. What happened next is a tale of two narratives. In the first, sanitized and romanticized version, told by English ballad writers in the years that followed, the pirates plundered the ship's cargo, as you might expect, and chatted up the pilgrim ladies, some even managing a little hanky-panky, all very proper and consensual, of course. Anyone who's ever watched a Hollywood pirate movie knows full well that prim and proper ladies love nothing more than being ravished by a dangerous and pheromonially masculine pirate. There's a whole literature of romance novels that attests to it, so it must be true. For his part, the aloof and handsome captain abstained from the wanton looting, but when the passengers were paraded on deck, his eyes came across a dazzling and beautiful maiden, beveiled, resplendent in jewels, and said to be the Emperor's own granddaughter. Dumbstruck with love, Captain Every proposed marriage there and then, even having an onboard Muslim cleric wed them on the spot, completely consensual, of course, as the swooning princess was overcome with passion and longing. When the crew stopped crying tears of joy, they carried on plundering, and the odd aristocrat on board was occasionally roughed up a bit in order to reveal the location of any treasure that he might have selfishly hidden. Eventually, having removed everything of value, the pirates departed, leaving the stricken victims to limp their way slowly back to port. The end. The other narrative, told to a local Muslim historian by survivors at the dockside when they returned, is rather more what one might expect. According to well-known local historian Kafi Khan, who gathered eyewitness reports, there were literally thousands of pirates swarming all over the ship, and though these infidels were a bunch of cowards and poor fighters, they apparently overcame the brave Muslim defenders through sheer weight of numbers, especially when their own cowardly Captain Ibrahim left his men to die, escaping below deck to his slave girls, as mentioned. The pirates now engaged in vicious brutality, going from cabin to cabin, looting, torturing, and murdering passengers without restraint, extracting, by horrible means, information on hidden treasure, and violating the sanctity of the pilgrim women on board, without consideration of their rank or status. Several noblewomen now threw themselves overboard and drowned rather than suffer being dishonored. When they were finally satisfied with the carnage they had wrought, the pirates sailed away, leaving the stricken ship to either sink or make its own way home. So, comparing these two narratives, sure, we can say the local account clearly exaggerated the pirates' numbers. Heads were going to roll for this humiliating failure after all, and we know that the cowardly Captain Ibrahim, left alive by Every to face his own fate, ended up in prison upon their return, and was then later executed by Emperor Aurangzeb following an inquiry into the disaster. Historian Kafi Khan, who wrote up the Mughal version of events in his book Muntakab ul-Lubab, or Selected Pearls, also noted the abduction of several noblewomen of the royal court, though he did not describe any of them as direct relatives of the emperor. Nevertheless, this crime, striking not only at the heart of the royal court, but more seriously, the violation of devout pilgrims, was an outrage that was about to have major international consequences. In the meantime, aboard the Fancy, the quartermaster got busy tallying the haul. No small task, given the sheer variety of goods. Silks, ivory, gemstones, gold and silver bullion by the barrel load. The East India Company, not inclined to exaggerate the value of this haul because they were ultimately held liable, estimated its value at over £600,000, equivalent to roughly £400 million in today's money, and quite possibly the greatest pirate heist in history. Two later pirates, by the names of John Taylor and Olivier Levasseur, plundered a Portuguese galleon out to sea called the Cabo in 1721, reportedly netting even more treasure, but there is some debate about its worth. And anyway, that's a story for another day. When the exhausted quartermaster finally split the profits, each man received over £1,000 worth of bullion. More than most sailors would ever make in their entire lifetime. On top, they also each received a share of gemstones, the value of which was even harder to estimate, and no doubt even more valuable. So the Fancy and her two accompanying ships now made their way to Bourbon, an island in the southern Indian Ocean, today known as Réunion, Reunion. It had only recently been settled and proved to be an ideal place to grow vanilla. Plantations needed workers, and the French soon began plundering Madagascar's native villages, taking away captives to work their farms. Réunion soon became another pirate hub. But what interested Captain Every was its burgeoning slave market. Going under the alias of Benjamin Bridgman, he posed as a slave trader. He certainly knew the jargon and the mechanics of it, having been one in the Bahamas not so long ago. The reason for the deception was that with a cargo hold full of Mughal bullion, he would easily be identified. So, like any self-respecting criminal, he needed to launder his ill-gotten gains. Slaves were about as close to a universal currency as you could hope to get in those days, so he purchased 90 of them, who would both help with the running of his ship, but could later then be on-sold elsewhere, for other currencies, making him virtually untraceable. The Danes and the French decided to stay on the island, thinking their chances of making a life under the French sphere of influence would give them greater safety than anywhere they might run into the East India Company, or worse, the Royal Navy. Every and the rest of the crew now debated their own best course of action. Some advocated sailing for Cayenne, another French outpost in South America, but the captain was intent on sailing to the Bahamas, where he already had a network of contacts and personal dealings with the corrupt governor, who would no doubt help them ditch the fancy, launder the rest of their money, and help them disperse further afield. For a fee, of course. After some wrangling, the crew finally agreed, and they set off on a new course halfway round the world again, a hard enough task as it was, but in this case with the additional burden of foregoing stops to ports along the way. Though there was not yet a bounty on his head, Captain Every was taking no chances. They were going to swing wide of Cape Town and instead aim for the tiny, uninhabited speck of Ascension Island, 1,000 miles west of the Atlantic coast of Africa. Now free of the other two vessels, the Fancy could run at full sail and arrived at their destination by April of 1695, 7 months after their daring robbery of the Gunsway. As luck would have it, their arrival coincided with the nesting season of marine turtles on the local beach, so the crew now easily captured 50 of them, bringing the reptiles aboard live, where they would provide fresh meat for the remainder of their journey. As they prepared to leave, another 17 of the crew opted to remain behind, to live virtually marooned on this windswept volcanic island, rather than risk being captured back in civilization. Just imagine, to forego taverns, rum, women, and gambling, and remain on such an isolated and lonely island, without any contact with the outside world, must give you some idea of the anxiety that was beginning to descend on them all, as the euphoria of their astronomical success now began to give way to the very real understanding that they were now marked men, loaded with incriminating bullion, forever looking over their shoulders. Pirate captains Francis Drake, Sir Walter Raleigh, and even the recently deceased Thomas Tew had lived the high life, feted and basking in the glory, if not notoriety, of their accomplishments. But it seems the crew of the Fancy were aware of the fact that there was something altogether different about this heist that would prevent their simply waltzing back into civilization and receiving the same kind of adulation. Several things were clear. Despite being fairly able to claim that their initial mutiny was based on a just cause, the reality was that they had nevertheless stolen a ship owned by a very high-profile MP, whose connections meant that the law was unlikely to see it their way. They had raided the personal flagship of the Emperor of India, arguably the richest man in the world, whose resources for vengeance were inexhaustible. As if the insult of despoiling his property wasn't bad enough, they had violated dozens of women pilgrims, a number of them from his own royal household, and subjected them to unspeakable crimes. Such a sacrilegious outrage was likely to have political consequences for England, whose tenuous trade relationship with the Mughal Empire would come under serious risk of termination, which of course meant that the East India Company, already having been granted extraordinary powers by the king, was going to take this incident as an existential threat and mount a manhunt of global proportions to placate the emperor and bring the pirates to visible justice. But for now, the 17 Robinson Crusoes buried their treasure and waved goodbye to their comrades as they set sail for Nassau, the main town of New Providence in the Bahamas. By March of 1696, they had laid anchor about 80 kilometres from town. In heading for the colonies, Every was betting on at least being out of the jurisdiction of the East India Company, as well as effectively leaving any Mughal expedition so far extended and noticeable as to give the pirates plenty of forewarning of their arrival. All that was left was to avoid the Royal Navy and to bribe the local governor to assist in their dispersal. Now, Hollywood has made much of Nassau being a pirate haven, as well as a notorious den of iniquity, but in 1696, it was still a backwater village. You see, the Spanish had burned it to the ground a decade before, and attempts at rebuilding had been stifled by the more recent conflict with the French, who had taken a nearby island and were in the process of mounting an invasion of the entire Bahamas. Trade had trickled to a standstill, and with it too, immigration and defence capability. The governor, Nicholas Trott, had rebuilt its coastal fort, but only had a few dozen men at his disposal to man its defences. The entire township was on high alert for a French attack which could come at any time. Captain Every, seeing the desperation of the situation, and still unsure as to whether news of their heist had reached the Americas, came up with a plan. He would continue to pass himself off as an interloper, the name used to describe unlicensed slave traders, and he would use his old alias of Benjamin Bridgman. Given the 90 slaves on board, this was a plausible option. He sent a couple of men to the governor with a letter, asking permission to come ashore and sell his captives, which would benefit the governor by increasing the available manpower. Given the population of the village was barely 60 people in total. But he would also ask permission for his crew to come ashore and to guarantee them freedom of movement. For this privilege, each man would contribute 20 pieces of 8 and 2 pieces of gold. The captain would himself, of course, contribute double, which would serve as a bribe to guarantee the governor's benevolence. On top of this monetary bribe, the governor would also be gifted the entire ship and everything within her, from the cannons and firearms to barrels of gunpowder, ivory, and a fortune in Arabic bullion. The Fancy, incredible as she was now a liability and would be instantly recognisable in any major port they sailed to. There was nothing for it but to emotionally let her go. Now, Governor Trott was no fool. He understood that he was most likely dealing with stolen goods and fugitives from justice. But fortunately for our pirates, news of their heist had not yet reached the Bahamas, and so the offer, extravagant as it was, didn't seem like a huge problem. The ship, anchored in the harbour, would act as a deterrent to the French. The slaves could be put to work building more defences, and perhaps some of the crew might choose to stay on and bolster their numbers in case of an attack. All of this could be used to justify his decision, should he be accused of collusion in the future, and indeed it was. So ashore they came, and immediately began planning their next move. As the traumatized victims disembarked from the stricken ships, News of their ordeal spread like wildfire throughout the Mughal Empire. Mobs of furious locals quickly turned their attention to the factories of the East India Company and began a series of riots intent on killing all the merchants and looting their warehouses. The local governor of Surat, also livid with rage, sent soldiers to arrest the company executives under charges of actually instigating the piracy and blockaded the gates of the East India Company headquarters. Some have suggested that his actions were meant not only to placate the rioters seeking justice, but also to actually protect the company officials themselves from being torn apart by the mob. By being under arrest, they were at least safe from the crowd, for now. The emperor, having received the news, now acted to close all the company factories and having their staff arrested. This couldn't have come at a worse time for the East India Company. As previously mentioned, back home in London, there were serious parliamentary inquiries going on which not only threatened to end their monopoly, but more importantly, it crashed their share price. That and the disastrous outcome of the idiotic bullying campaign, we now call Child's War, had devastated the company's finances. To give you some idea of their position, in 1684, the company's annual profits were recorded at being over £800,000. By the time of the heist, a mere decade later, it had dropped to an abysmal £30,000. Despite the company's misdealings, the English Parliament very quickly saw the heist as a much bigger problem, since Emperor Aurangzeb now threatened to ban all English from ever trading in India again. It passed emergency measures, disavowing Every and his entire crew, declaring him hostis humani generis, a Latin legal term that means enemy of all mankind. Such a label instantly makes one an outlaw anywhere in the world and provides a naval warrant for all nations to capture, try, and hang the individual as a common enemy, regardless of the diplomatic relationships that might be in play. A reward of £500 was offered for information leading to his arrest, to which the East India Company headquarters now added £1,000 of their own. Any former crew member who aided in Every's capture would instantly earn himself a free pardon. Having so recently tested Emperor Aurangzeb's patience, the company knew it had to go all out to mitigate the damage the heist caused to their benefactor. So a formal offer was made to compensate the emperor for all losses incurred by the robbery, and to pay a further indemnity on top of what they were already paying for their Child's War fiasco, to be given as tribute each year. But even more crucially, the East India Company now made a historic decision to act as a naval defence contractor, escorting Hajj pilgrims and merchant fleets to the Red Sea, and to patrol the entire Indian Ocean and rid it once and for all of piracy. Tense negotiations continued, crowds continued to riot, and the fate of the English, holed up in prison, hung in the balance. But the emperor's advisers and port authorities, in the end, recognized the huge profits to be made from the English trade, and now with this assurance of naval policing, he relented, such that 6 months after Every's infamous heist, the emperor proclaimed the East India Company's innocence, and the company was now back in business. Some historians have suggested that this new naval patrol emphasis led to a proliferation of English company warships in the region that would eventually lead to their complete domination of the high seas. In the coming decades, the naval task force struggled to achieve its objectives. Indeed, William Kidd, hired by the company to patrol the Red Sea coast, found that if you can't beat them, join them, becoming one of the more notorious Red Sea pirates himself, before he was eventually caught and hanged. But as the Mughal Empire's interior wars continued unabated, their fortunes eventually began to fade, and this massive new English naval presence would ultimately facilitate their eventual incursion and domination of the fringe regions of Mughal holdings, from where the East India Company would go on to become the largest private army and navy in history. Captain Every's heist, though he could never know it, had a direct impact on what would eventually become the British Raj and transform the soon-to-be-renamed Great Britain into the global superpower that Mughal India once herself was. When news finally reached Nassau, Governor Trott, true to his word, tipped off Every and his men, giving them ample time to depart, before formally reporting his contact with the pirates, while the fancy was conveniently lost by being broken up on local rocks in a storm, some say intentionally. The crew now scrambled to make their long-anticipated getaway. 50 or so men bought a small ship and sailed towards Charleston in the Carolinas, dispersing from there all throughout the American colonies. In time, some occasional news would reach London of drunken sailors in a pub, bragging about their exploits on the fancy, but none were ever arrested or faced justice, in a group of colonies increasingly disinclined to cooperate with demands from the motherland. Recently, coins belonging to the lost Mughal treasure fleet have been found in Rhode Island, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and North Carolina. 20 others purchased a small ship as well and headed straight for England, hoping to slip under the nose of authorities through the many busy ports along the Thames and make their way quietly home. They were boldly gambling on the assumption that nobody would think they would be stupid enough to sail right into the heart of London. Captain Every, along with his senior officers, also purchased a vessel and was similarly keen to go home, but being more cautious, he gave his former companions conflicting stories of their intended destination and slipped away quietly, headed for Ireland, hoping to offload themselves in some lonely and isolated location where there were few witnesses. 6 or 7 other men stayed on in Nassau, got married, and as the town began to prosper, eventually disappeared from the record, despite a sham local investigation in the following years. Arriving in a small port north of Belfast, Every's crew bribed their way through customs and were making their way south to Dublin when Every suddenly stopped and told his companions he would now go his own way, variously mentioning Scotland, and then down to his home in the south of England. As the men dispersed, the East India Company headquarters, having sent out alerts across the globe, finally received news back from Nassau, and the suggestion that Every and his men may be in Ireland. A flurry of notices were now issued across the entire country, with rewards for any information that led to their capture. A huge dragnet now scoured the British Isles as agents interviewed hundreds of informants, all claiming to have seen the pirate leader and his crew. One by one, they were nabbed. Some had blabbered, others were arrested by suspicious local officials. Ship's coxswain, John Dan, had rambled across the entire country before being arrested in his own hometown, not because somebody recognized him, but because a maid at the inn where he was staying lifted his jacket while cleaning one morning and found it exceedingly heavy. She reported this to the local authorities, who soon found the jacket with what was described as 1,000 Turkish coins sewn into its lining. Dan's roving days were over. By September 1696, the authorities had 8 former crew members under arrest, though the captain was still at large. Pressure was mounting for a show trial to prove to the Mughal emperor that the English were serious about doling out justice. Two of them, John Dan and Philip Middleton, had agreed to testify against the others and so were given immunity. Now, despite the small number of remaining defendants, a public trial was nevertheless opened in October of that year, to be overseen by a who's who of the most well-known chief justices from every branch of the judiciary, naval, civil, common, and even high court, one of whom had previously heard and dismissed the lawsuit of the sailors' wives for unpaid wages, if you recall, when they were still stuck in Spain. Moreover, the presiding bench of judges had already previously convicted Captain Every as a hostis humani generis, with the close association and support of directors of the East India Company and even the Lord Mayor of London, the brother of, you guessed it, James Houblon, owner of the Fancy, that is to say, the Charles II. To suggest that both the prosecution and judiciary bench had a substantial conflict of interest in the case would be a massive understatement, but as far as they were concerned, it was a political imperative that these men be made an example of, even if it made a mockery of the English justice system. This was the kind of corrupt, rigged plutocracy that, ironically, led ordinary folk to turn to piracy and to protect and celebrate those who actually beat the system. The indictment of piracy against the property of the Mughal emperor was read to the 6 defendants, who, it should be said, were denied legal representation, and when they were asked how they plead, 5 of them responded not guilty. The trial now began in earnest, with the 2 treacherous crew members giving a full account of the adventure, from the mutiny itself all the way down to the horrific, gory details of the attack on the Gunsway, the abuse of its passengers, and their eventual deal with the governor of Nassau. The prosecutor reminded the jury about the very real political and economic consequences this case would have for the future of England. It was open and shut, indisputable. So just imagine the furor when the presiding judge turned to the jury and they unanimously declared every single defendant, including the captain on trial in absentia, as not guilty. The entire courtroom erupted. People watching from outside cheered, and the bewildered defendants stood there, completely stunned, though not more than the bench of judges, who had been made to look like complete mugs. Shockwaves rippled throughout the city as news criers spread the word and pamphleteers wrote ballads. This was the kind of busted stitch-up that creates legends. From Robin Hood to Captain Kidd, the English have a continuous pantheon of outlaws who fought the system and were viewed as heroes by the voiceless working class who, it should be said, were often themselves the victims of these very outlaws. But the public jubilation was short-lived. Far from being released, the exonerated defendants were thrown back into prison, while the prosecution and judges met to consider what to do next. The verdict was a disaster. A conviction was supposed to demonstrate to Aurangzeb and the entire world that England was serious about suppressing piracy. But now the emperor would be justified in believing that they were probably behind the heist all along. It would be the end of the fragile agreement they had just reached with him. It might even spell war. By now, Captain Every's exploits had become legendary, and the public were far more inclined to support him over the business dealings of a corrupt company and a heathen foreign power. So what the prosecution now came up with was a second trial, not for the same crime of piracy, because double jeopardy laws made that impossible, but this time they would be indicted for mutiny, another crime punishable by death, and this time they would be much more careful about picking the jury. So within just 2 weeks, the six defendants once again found themselves in the dock, and a new set of charges were read out against them, this time focusing on events in Spain, though weaving, for the record, references to piratical intent and the Mughal emperor. The defendants were confused, and several pleaded ignorance of why they were even being detained. The judge brushed off their confusion and now turned to the jury and gave them a stinging missive on their duty to king and country, warning them not to make the same error of judgment as the previous jury had done. It was a scarcely veiled threat that would have made them squirm in their seats. Seriously, you can't make this stuff up. Anyway, this time, 5 of the defendants again pleaded innocent, with only one of them, Joseph Dawson, pleading guilty, now as he did the last time. The others insisted that they had no choice but to participate in the mutiny, claiming that it was only officers who were given the option to return to shore. Now, normally, a trial of this nature would require the prosecution to prove the defendants guilty. But in this case, the opposite, the presumption of guilt, had already been made, and it was the defendants instead who were required to prove their innocence. Something that would never fly today, and it boggles the mind to think that no lawyers at the time were prepared to voice their concerns or publicize their opposition. So it was that several witnesses from the mutiny in Spain now gave additional evidence, 2 key items being that, firstly, there was still space in the rowboat for others who wished to leave, with Every himself calling for those who wanted to leave to step forward, and the second being the division of spoils, equally among all the men. You see, it was one thing to claim not being paid and requisitioning a fair portion of loot to compensate you. But to accept the astronomical division of plunder they gained from the gunsway was something else entirely, and suggested that the crew were now well beyond anything that resembled merely being employees. They were criminals sharing in the spoils of a crime that they were fully engaged in, and much was made of this aspect of the evidence, despite the fact that they had already been acquitted of piracy. Any defense lawyer would have objected to its use as immaterial to the case at hand. But these men, and the jury that listened to it, were increasingly bamboozled by unrestrained prosecutors who made no attempt to stay on topic, and by judges who were complicit. Unsurprisingly, the verdict this time went the other way, and the defendants were led away while the judge considered the sentence. Within days, they were back before him and begging the court's mercy. The penalty, of course, was death by hanging, and only Joseph Dawson, who pleaded guilty, was spared. The rest were hanged on November the 25th, 1696, at Execution Dock on the River Thames, and left there for several days as a warning to passers-by of the long arm of the law, despite the fact that actually almost the entire crew had got away. Nothing more was ever heard of Captain Every, though reports proliferated about sightings throughout the country. Some believed he wandered about, having lost his fortune, being swindled by Bristol merchants. Others that he had been robbed and that he died an anonymous pauper in a cautionary sermon no doubt meant to discourage others from a similar career. But storytellers also began to craft incredible tales of his having returned to Madagascar, with his fortune and princess bride, becoming a pirate king with his own pirate republic, much like would eventually occur in settlements throughout the Caribbean. No other evidence exists as to the fate of the women taken during the robbery, and theirs must remain a tragic mystery, like so many others that have never been documented. Writers such as Daniel Defoe, who would go on to romanticise Every's exploits, which, like that of Drake and Raleigh before him, would inspire a new generation of pirates, many of them mimicking his actions, in the coming golden age of piracy, such that much of what we conceive today as stereotypical was largely thanks to Captain Every and to some degree Captain Tew. So what can we say about Captain Every, the mysterious nobody who got away with the greatest treasure heist in history? It's pretty clear that despite the original cause of the mutiny, any honest appraisal of his subsequent career would hardly justify his being described as a hero. But Every's heist of the Ganj Isawai does make you wonder how it is that cultures will often adopt outlaws as folk heroes, while viewing their ruling classes as villains, when, not so long ago, it was the kings of old who held that honour in the public imagination. What does it say about a society and its contemporary view of justice, of oppressors and underdogs, or of our propensity to justify the means by the ends? Captain Every and his crew committed some unspeakably horrible crimes, almost started a war, and though they could never know it, facilitated a course of action that would change the face of the entire world, eventually making England, soon to become Great Britain, a global colonialist superpower. These pirates inspired tales of incredible riches and successes that infused the public imagination, while simultaneously highlighting the corruption of a corporate monopoly and the regime that supported it. It's perhaps not too outlandish to suggest that the explosion in pirate activity that followed Every's heist led to a gradual re-evaluation of the relationship between a state and its subjects, and that the egalitarian pirate code that governed these outlaws even perhaps made its way into the philosophical debates that eventually transformed British society itself. Across the Atlantic, these principles maybe even influenced the formation of an entirely new nation and its astonishingly egalitarian constitution. Who knows? If you enjoy this content, please take a moment to support my work by making a small donation through the links on the podcast website, or better still, by signing up as a Patreon supporter, where you can communicate with me directly, engage with the Heroes and Legends community, and get better insights and even involvement in my work and future videos. A video montage of this podcast also appears on our YouTube Heroes and Legends documentary channel. Please feel free to visit, like and share, and as always, thanks for listening.